Welcome to another episode of the Examine Life Podcast, a podcast where we take some of life's thorniest questions and deconstruct them in a way that is pragmatic and philosophical so that you can lead a more productive, examined, and joyful life. My name is Kehi. Today's question is, what are psychedelics like? So I'm going to start you off with a journey that starts with marriage therapy, of all places. Yes. So I've been very open with y'all. You know that we have done different modalities of couples therapy. And the first modality we did was very traditional, where it was a lot of talking, communication styles, things like basically communication oriented. The second one we thought would go a little bit more inward. They were a little bit more spiritual, the people that we were working with. But we were in for a surprise. So picture the scene. We were in an Airbnb in Topanga, which is about an hour from our house. My in-laws are watching our kids. It's a random Thursday night. And the therapists come to us. We've been there for one day already, and it's just us. And the therapists come to us and they say, you know, you guys have been doing really good with the communication stuff, some of the spiritual introspection. Have you thought about doing psychedelics together? Now, this was not what we signed up for. This was not part of the plan. And next thing you know, it is Friday morning, 11 a.m., and Lisa and I are laying on a bed with an eye mask that looks, you know, might as well have been an Apple Vision Pro, taking a dose of MDMA and psilocybin, right? So picture that. It's Friday morning. Your kids are off at school with their in-laws, with your in-laws watching them. You're laying in a bed with your wife right next to you, two therapists in the room the entire time with an eye mask over your eyes, about to go in for 8, 7, 8, 10 hours. And the guidance was, you know, we recommend that you actually don't talk to each other, husband and wife, and really just observe, right? So that is the scene that I'm going to set you up with. And I'm going to talk about my side of the journey. I want to respect Lisa's side of it. There's some places where they come together, but one day we'll do an episode with Lisa and she'll share all of this. Now, before we jump into what happened when I put the Apple Vision goggles on, nature's Apple Vision goggles, I want to invite you all to our group coaching programs. Now, these programs, we've run three cohorts. They are near and dear to my heart. They are these beautiful gatherings of people who have hit this enough point, this pivot point, and then are asking themselves, like, is this it? Am I going to continue to go through the motions doing this? There's got to be a way to get my time freedom back. So if you are in this phase where you have resources, you have the credentials to do something different, but are scared, check out radreads.co/coaching. All right. So they started us off with what they called the heart opener, which is a heavy dose of MDMA. And before we jump into the actual experience, I'll share a little bit about my experience with those plants, with the medicine, as they like to call it. And it was all recreational. Now, I wouldn't say it was that heavy. I would say I had a 5 to 7 year run of going to Twilo and different nightclubs in New York in that kind of techno music scene. So that was kind of my experience there. And then in reality, and occasionally had done mushrooms recreationally, I think maybe 4 times in my life prior, three or four times. And to be honest, that was mostly in my 20s, basically before I had kids. At that point, after having kids, it felt somewhat, not irresponsible per se, because it was always done responsibly, but it felt a little, how should I say it? It felt like the recovery actually wasn't going to be there. And so, you know, mix of irresponsibility and not having the time to recover properly just kind of made doing things like that recreationally just not as fun. The other thing I want to say is, as before I jump in, it's like, do not do this on your own. This is not advice. This is not a recommendation. The people we were with, we did numerous reference checks on. They were connected to friends. We then interviewed them. We had a high trust factor. They were there the entire time. We didn't have to drive the next day. So just want to reinforce that there's a lot of shady folks out there kind of capitalizing on this type of work. So just wanted to put that out for you. Okay, so drop in 10:45 in the morning, earliest I've ever done MDMA. And it's a heavy dose. I don't know. I'm a pill guy, so it probably felt like two pills if I had to kind of translate the experience. But again, it's very, very, very different to take these kind of medicine substances in pure silence. Right? Think about the time you're doing it at Coachella, in a nightclub, at a party, at a bar. Very with friends, there's so much stimulation. Here, it was the exact opposite. Zero stimulation, right? I mean, obviously your body is feeling stuff, but zero, there's no none of that. Zero stimulation, just you and your thoughts. And I share this with people. They're like, fucking A, no fucking way. Do I want to be with my thoughts, with my spouse next to me, kind of quote unquote out of control? And that's why we had the two therapists that were there the entire time. I think they were probably like playing Wordle and shit while we were going through these crazy, crazy journeys. Okay, so they drop you in with this the MDMA, and right away it takes probably like 15 minutes to kick in, but it was just at that moment, just like pure bliss, right? And that was a more familiar experience. It's very kind of high serotonin. It's very beautiful. It's very colorful. Again, remember, you've got the eye mask now, but the sleeping mask, but really it's like an Apple Vision Pro where you're just going into these crazy, crazy worlds. So it started off with the MDMA, and it was just a flash of colors. And just, you know, kind of relaxing and just a lot of gratitude kind of overcoming me. And the first thing that I remember, oh, keep in mind, this was over a year ago. So I am doing this all from memory. So it can give you some context of how salient, I'll probably go 40, 50 minutes, pure memory, which can tell you the salience of the experience. So you're just these beautiful hallucinations. And as it's happening, of course, my brain would go there. I see a PowerPoint deck. Yes, a slide of PowerPoints, a deck of PowerPoint slides. And as these slides are flipping over, I'm seeing all of, each page has a friend and a family member. And throughout, as these pages are flipping, it is just like, I love you so much. I'm so grateful for you. Thank you for your friendship. It's just this moment of like, God, I'm so lucky to have these amazing people in my life. So yes, the first thing I hallucinated was indeed a PowerPoint presentation. I will say about that point, about the PowerPoint presentation, was that there were a few friends and people in my life who there was a little bit of tension between us. And the tension could have been, you know, maybe you have to wear a mask around that person, or maybe they weren't treating you the way you deserve to be treated. And again, these were all very, very close friends. Or maybe there was just a dearth in communication. And I do remember that in that moment, it was very clear to me where there was that, which friends had some tension in the relationship. And in fact, a year later, I can still recall who those friends are. In some cases, I took it upon myself to, or I didn't. In some cases, I attempted to kind of heal whatever was there outstanding. In other places, there wasn't the opportunity or there wasn't the desire. So that was that kind of PowerPoint slide version. It's funny to describe it in a 2 or 3 minute bit where it probably lasted for, I mean, you have no sense of time, literally no sense of time, but it probably, if I had to guess, was a like 2 hour, 90 minute experience. And I know this because at some point during that that MDMA part, they come in and offer you the psilocybin. So this, the reason why they do it is because like they call it the heart opener. MDMA is much less cerebral. It's much, I don't know the science, but it's like much more of a happy place. And I think the psilocybin can be mixed results, right? This is where you hear of kind of like bad trips and vomiting. Like very few people vomit from MDMA, which by the way, can be very scary when you are in your journey. Okay. So they give you the psilocybin. At that point, you know, Lisa and I are not talking. It's pitch dark. I haven't taken the eye mask off. I don't think I took the mask off for 6 hours because I did not want to, like I was in it. I was fucking in it. So then they give the psilocybin. And once that kicks in, it was kind of like, you know, the movie Soul? It's a Pixar movie where the person falls into a manhole and basically it kind of like recreates it's your soul, right? So it's kind of showing you death. And so I was literally, and it has this beautiful animation because he's like, it's colorful. He's walking down the street. There's lights and sounds and all that. And then he falls in this manhole and just drops. And you're kind of like free falling and you don't really, it's pitch black and complete silence. And you're just kind of like wailing and it's a little bit like that scary weightlessness feeling that you get on a roller coaster in pitch blackness with no concept of time, no concept of when the drop is going to stop, in complete silence. Now in that moment, I was wondering, I was like, oh shit. And there was a part of me, I'd say like a 30% part of me that was scared of having a bad trip, right? I was like, oh shit. You know, I've done a lot of work along the way. I'd actually told the therapist before, like I'm scared of what I might see, right? Might be a work thing, might be a relationship thing, might be a thing about me, how I hold myself to be true. I was very scared that something would puncture my existing worldview and the consequences of that were something that I wouldn't want, right? And they always give this like extreme examples, like you go and do it and you like realize you don't want to be married. Like I didn't have that fear, but I had probably some derivatives of like, what if I actually came into that period with a lot of work questions. But what if I don't care about money, or what if I don't want to be social anymore? Like things like that were so embedded in my identity, in my sense of self, that I was afraid of what it could puncture. So you drop down in the soul moment. And that was when I had that, oh shit moment. And I think I finally landed. And this is where it gets crazy telling these stories, because you're either going to think that I've fucking lost my mind and I'm batshit crazy and it's going to sound completely over the top, or you're going to be completely bought in. I don't think there is an in-between there. So I drop into this time period, which is like, it's almost like it's like Game of Thrones, right? So it's just, I don't even know how you describe the architecture or land, but it feels like it's Game of Thrones. It's not actually Game of Thrones, but it's that aesthetic. It's that nature scene. It's that time period. and in this Game of Thrones situation. And I kind of don't really know who I am. Like, I can't see myself. Like, am I, you know, John Stark? None of that. Like, I actually can't see myself. So in this, during this moment, this like procession starts to come through, this procession, and it's like this golden chariot with thousands and thousands of soldiers and serfs and warlords and infantry around it, and it's gold and it's fiery and it's powerful, and it embodies this like incredible energy and strength and power. And who do I see there as the Daenerys Targaryen? Is my wife Lisa. And I think it's, you're probably saying to yourself, like, wow, what a cliche. Like, he saw this powerful woman and it was his wife. Like, yeah, haha. Like, okay, cool, bro. But I think it's an interesting concept here, is because part of the reason we were in that room, in that therapy session, is because I don't communicate that feeling to her ever. She doesn't feel it. We can talk about why I don't do it. I probably project that feeling of this like greatness more on myself. And so it was very different. Because in fact, it was one of the reasons why we were in that room, right? And so let me give some like a little bit of context. Like, I'm a very dominant personality. I'm very outwardly self-confident. I have my own giant slate of insecurities, but very outwardly self-confident, a big talker, some could say, you know, bordering with narcissistic tendencies. But I'm a big personality, and that is the personality that I uphold in our marriage, in many of our social groups. And what was happening here was it was completely inverted. And I was just at the base of this, seeing this fiery, powerful goddess. And I wasn't even supposed to say anything to her, because I'm in my own thoughts, even though this fiery goddess is literally laying right next to me. We're both like sweating like motherfuckers at this point. This is probably 2.5 hours in. And all I kept saying to myself was, it's Lisa time, right? And I think that there was this, it was like, it's Lisa time. It's Lisa time. It's Lisa time. It's Lisa. To the point, we'll talk about the tattoo. I didn't get it yet, but it's on my... All of my tattoos are typography, have Cambodia and these flight numbers, so it wouldn't make sense. But it's Lisa time. It's Lisa time. It's Lisa time. And again, while I am a very supporting husband, I'm not a very openly cheerleading husband. I'm more like the quiet infrastructure guy. It's like, oh, you need... Like, we need this thing done, I'll do it. We need this money here, I'll make that happen. We need to make this decision, I'll make that. That's my normal mode of support, not the cheerleading, like, you're incredible, you're amazing. So it was just like interesting to just see that there with this kind of refrain that kept going. You'll hear this over and over again. There was these refrains like, it's Lisa time, it's Lisa time, it's Lisa time. And I couldn't tell her this. So this crazy Game of Thrones scene where my wife is Daenerys Targaryen and I'm just watching it. And really, this concept, you've heard me say this in a few of the podcasts, this concept came up that it just kept coming up was I'm tired. I'm tired. I'm so tired. This is about me. I've been pushing so hard when I was a kid, just to be seen, to do all my things that I did, you know, learning how to invest and all that stuff, entrepreneurship as a kid, college, Wall Street, entrepreneurship, just going hard, a lot of pressure on myself. And this has come up in different modalities of therapy since then. So I think like the seed was planted here, and this feeling of I'm tired was starting to show up, and I'm tired. And it's almost like, there's a part of me that loves being the center, a huge part of me that loves being the center of attention. And what was happening in that moment is like, okay, this is the time for you to step aside. Right. And maybe that was that scary premonition that I was getting. It's like, oh, what if it's not always about me? Right. What if I'm not the center and I step aside, I'm the behind the scenes. And what was coming up here is that, you know, the person who I love the most actually needed a lot of this cheerleading, but it was something that I was incapable of providing, unwilling. I don't know. I really don't know. I'm scared, maybe. And so this concept of it was just, and there's so many ways. I'm so many people's cheerleaders. And this is probably why we were in marriage therapy. I'm so many people's, like you could DM me and ask for my advice on something. I'll send you a 10-minute video back and cheering you on, telling you got this. But somewhere, somehow in my own marriage, that is difficult for me to do. And that leads to the next part. So once that scene, it was cool. It's like different scenes. Once that part faded, the Daenerys Targaryen, by the way, I am going to get the tattoo. It's Lisa time on my ribs, like right here. I said I'd wait 6 months because I didn't want to be that guy that gets a tattoo right after a psychedelic. I wait 6 months, it's been a year. Now I'm just trying to find the artist. Now, if anyone's listening to this, I know that a lot of tattoo artists, people find them just directly through Instagram. So the concept of the studios, like, kind of gone. So it's almost given me too many options. Like, I mean, look on Instagram for tattoo artists, like that's a full-time job. So if anyone has experience with getting tattoos from Instagram artists in your area, let me know. Okay. So why was I scared to kind of put other people out there, support other people? And why did I always need to get all the airtime, all the attention? That leads to another, the next part of the journey, which was a question that I kept having that led us there, which was, why are you so emotionally shut off to the people you love, and specifically to Lisa? And I've come to learn actually that there's a term called counterdependence. And counterdependence is when you are so scared of being alone that you basically, I'm going to butcher it, but you basically push everyone away so that they can never leave you, right? So you keep everyone's at arm's length so that deep inside, you know that you'll always be safe in the place that you know best, which is being alone. So it's this kind of like, you like push people, you actively push people away. You don't let them get too close, because if they're close, then they can leave you, they can hurt you. But if they're always at an arm length, they can't hurt you, so to speak, but also they can't love you so dearly because you don't let them, right? So counterdependence is a term that I've found out, and this actually came up. And so after the Game of Thrones scene, it basically was like, it was like having a conversation with yourself, right? And your consciousness or some higher level, but that person has all the information about you and kind of sees you in this purest light. And you, the other person talking, are you with the baggage, the scars, the insecurities, and so on. So as I'm talking to myself about this question, why are you so emotionally cut off? These words just come out. And the words are, and I'm asking, why am I so emotionally distant from Lisa? And the words are, I'm scared of loving you too much, because then it could all be taken away. Right? It's like, it's moving just to remember that. I haven't thought about this specifically in a while, but I'm scared of loving you too much for fear that it could all be taken away. Sounds like some fucking TV quote. And it's crazy to say that out loud so concisely while also knowing like how true that is about myself. And so, you know, you can imagine that like I'm building up all these moments, these stories, these observations while I'm unable to really communicate them. I did kind of like tap Lisa. I'm like, hey, it's Lisa time. And she's like, huh? And I was like, I'll tell you later. to really show how we were on in our own world. So yeah, that counterdependence and that fear of getting too close. I mean, I have always had, I thought for many, many, many years growing up that like no one would ever want to marry me, be with me. I would be by myself my whole life. And I think that there are these walls that I've put up that's like, if I'm by myself my whole life, like, cool, I'm good. But that's not a healthy way. That is not a healthy way to live. So next up, I recall really starting to sweat and my lips were moving and I was just like kind of chattering. And the therapist after would be like, we didn't know what was going on, but your lips were just moving at this like very, very fast pace. You were kind of like convulsing a bit. Again, nothing scary. I think they've seen some shit. Convulsing, but in a healthy way. And what I remember just saying over and over and over and over and over and over again was, I just want to be a good boy. I just want to be good. I just kept saying it. That's what my lips were mouthing. I just want to be a good boy. 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 And there's so much there, right? I just want to be good. It's, I want to be a good boy. And there, you know, you could think about people pleasing or just like wanting to, just this innate fear that you're not a good person. But then you tack on the boy part and there's this child there that is just, and to her credit, Lisa's just, she said, like, behind all the masks that you wear, the way you show up, the way you work, you know, the intensity that you bring to situations, like, she's like, you can see the little boy there. Maybe that's the case for everyone. I don't know. But I do, like, I do have this scared little boy in me. I know, and that's why I do all the things that I do. And I know that it comes from low self-esteem and some of the abandonment things that I talked about and being alone and all that stuff. But it gave me so much tenderness for that boy. I used to be so hard on myself, and that's definitely waned. I think now I'm still very hard on myself, but in a, just like a more, it's much quieter, it's healthier, but it's still not particularly healthy. There is this like really quiet intensity. I'm sure you see it if you listen to a lot of these episodes. So I just want to be a good boy. I just want to be a good boy. I just want to be a good boy. There's like convulsing. And then the pure me, the conscious me, whatever you want to call him, kind of like puts his hand on me and says, "Kay, you don't have to be good. You are good." And that was like, I know they always, that was this moment, like I will never forget that moment. You don't have to be good. You are good. Maybe many of you listening to this would benefit from hearing that, because it's true. And it just like in that moment, and again, time, who I can't, I have no, I mean, this is probably 4 or 5 hours into it, no recollection of time. But in that moment, I'm like, God, I make so much sense to myself. Right? Like everything just fell into place, so to speak. I just made so much sense to myself. And all the layers of doing, right? Doing just to be seen as good, as this good boy. It just made me make a lot of sense to myself. All right. Then a few other things that came up. Those were like kind of the core of the experience. A few other things that came up. When I entered the therapy, it was right in the kind of the lowest point of Rad Reads, where we had blown up the course business. Things weren't going well. Lots of layoffs. I was very unmotivated. This was actually before this podcast started. It was right around when it started. I think the experience might have catalyzed this podcast. But I kept wanting, like my brain, my K brain, not my all-knowing brain, always was like, what should I do about work? And so like throughout the journey, all these questions, like, what should I do about work? What should I do about work? And every time that question would come up, it would go from this like insanely bright colors to a black and white newspaper. Every time I asked about work, it would go from bright colors to a black and white newspaper. I know, isn't that, it's wild to me, where it was like my soul was saying to me, okay, there's nothing to think about here. There's nothing to do here. Just stay with this lush learning that you have about yourself here. All right. So I thought that was funny, like going in, and it really put things in perspective. It's like, wow, work is really this kind of black and white. Well, you like put it on this, like this pedestal, but it's really just this kind of blah, black and white, tepid thing in this like much, much richer texture of your life. And then the last thing that really struck with me or resonated was that fear going into it. And so I started to talk to myself about this fear that I would come out changed, this punctured sense of self. What was I going to see on the other side? And so I started asking myself, you know, throughout the journey, it's like, you know, you were so scared. And I remember coming out of it, I was like, I saw what was on the other side of that fear. I saw what was on the other side of punctured sense of self. I saw the transformation, the new, what was really like what was really beneath the layers, right? And here's what I saw. A big, squishy love ball. Yep. Those were the exact words. He was like, hey, underneath all those layers, that fear, the things you puncture, rip off, you're just a big, squishy love ball. I have no idea where that came from. It's not like I picture there was a, you know, Kirby from Mario Brothers. Like that's kind of the image that I was seeing. That phrase has never been used in my family, to my knowledge. It's never been a way that I've referred to myself. But it did make a lot of sense to me because, yes, I was. That is how I see myself in many ways. Like when I kind of let go of all the projection and how I want to show up, like just a big squishy, like I think I'm a fundamentally happy, loving person. And I think that I forget that about myself often. And so I hope that you experience, you get to meet the big squishy love ball. I hope you've seen that in me. I hope to see that in myself more. And thank you for listening.